there are lots of positivities in our diversity, and we're still only looking at the challenge and behaviour rather than addressing it. Wow, how can we build this up? And what happens in the meantime is that because we're not putting in that early intervention, because we're not putting in that training, we're ending up with a lot of children and young people out of education who then are entering adulthood who can't access work and are going to be more of a drain on society. Rather than seeing it as we put in that early intervention, I'd say at least 75-80% of SEND children and young people could be proactive when they reach adulthood and putting a lot into society. And I think we're still approaching it in a very archaic system where either we'll ignore it until it gets too difficult and then we'll try and fix it.
Welcome to the School Behaviour Secrets podcast. I'm your host, Simon Currigan. My co-host is Emma Shackleton, and we're obsessed with helping teachers, school leaders, parents, and of course students when classroom behaviour gets in the way of success. We're going to share the tried and tested secrets to classroom management, behavioural special needs, whole school strategy, and more, all with the aim of helping your students reach their true potential. Plus, we'll be letting you eavesdrop on our conversations with thought leaders from around the world, so you'll get to hear the latest evidence-based strategies before anyone else. This is the School Behaviour Secrets podcast.
Hi there, and welcome to another episode of School Behaviour Secrets. My name's Simon Currigan. Sean Covey hates wasted time. In fact, he once said, one of the few things that can't be recycled is wasted time. So if he's listening to this podcast, he's going to be furious. I'm joined today by my wonderful co-host, Emma Shackleton. Hi, Emma.
Hi, Simon. Go on, what have you got for me today?
A question.
Really? What a surprise.
Women are more likely to suffer severe car injuries than men, but by what percentage?
Is it around 50%? And the reason I'm thinking is because they're doing the lion's share of ferrying the kids to school and various and numerous sporting activities. Maybe more journeys equals more likelihood of getting into an accident?
Not a bad guess. I'm not sure about your reasoning, but the answer is 47% are more likely to have a severe car injury.
Okay, why is that?
Well, according to a study into 45,000 crash injuries over 11 years in the US, it turns out that safety features in cars are designed for the male form. So, you know, like the height of things like head restraints are more suited to the average height of a male rather than a female, stuff like that. So the environment of the car is less suitable for keeping women safe.
It's surprising, actually, how many things have been designed by men for men. Okay, so how is this related to today's episode?
So today I interview Nikki Day, who's a parent of an autistic child and an educational and parental support advisor. She got in touch with us following an episode we released on using ABA, or Applied Behaviour Analysis, to support kids with behaviour change, to say that she had concerns about how some practitioners were using ABA in terms of autism, particularly their claims that they were able to cure children of autism using ABA. And she wanted to talk about the important difference between supporting kids with their needs as opposed to trying to normalize them or train them out of their autism.
Ah, that does sound like a really important conversation to have.
Yeah, definitely. And just to be clear, she wasn't criticizing our guest in the previous episode, who in no way suggested autism could be cured or ABA is a method for doing so.
Okay, but before we press play on Simon's interview with Nikki, I'd like to ask for your help. If you listen to this interview and find the insights and discussion valuable, don't keep them to yourself. Please open up your podcast app, click the share button, and send this episode to a couple of your colleagues or even school leaders that you work with that you think would find it useful. That helps the information and our podcast to spread even further so that we can help more teachers and pupils in school. Actually, the other day I was speaking to a head teacher who told me that he often shares our podcast with people that he meets on his dog walks. Anyway, without further ado, here's Simon's interview with Nikki Day.
Today I'm excited to welcome Nikki Day to the show. Nikki is a single parent of three sons, one of whom is autistic, and she found herself in the position of having to give up work when he was in primary school due to his frequent meltdowns, and fought to get her son assessed for a statement of educational needs and placed in special school. At that time, she was approached for advice from a parent in a mainstream school about getting support for their child, and her journey into being an education and support advisor began. She took a university course in psychology, which incorporated modules on autism,
and now supports parents around provision for pupils with special educational needs in school, EHCP applications, appeals and tribunals, as well as training for parents and professionals. Nikki, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So Nikki, you got in touch with me following our episode on using ABA or Applied Behaviour Analysis to support kids in school. And you were concerned that we were advocating the use of ABA in schools because some professionals claim to use it to cure, and I'm putting the word cure in inverted commas here, autistic behaviour in kids. And you wanted to respond to those issues. Before we get to that, let's start with some basics. From a scientific, psychological perspective, can you tell us a little about what autism actually is?
Thank you, Simon. Well, autism is a neurological condition. So it's really important for people to realize that you're born with this condition and that the brain is wired differently. It's nothing to do with the environment or parenting or any of those things. It's the fact that your brain's wired differently. Autism would then tend to, because the brain is different, affect certain areas. So it will affect the difficulties and differences around communication, around interaction, around how the brain is around sensory issues. And the other areas is the fixed interest, which tends to be when there's someone with autism finds something they like because the world is so crazy around them, they tend to stick to that one thing because it makes them feel in control and safe rather than they're being controlling. It's just, it's something that they know and like very much. And that basically in a nutshell, really.
For the people listening, can you give us some concrete examples? You said there are issues around communication. Can you give me some concrete examples of what that might look like in school?
Well, communication will be difficult with autism because of the way their brain is. They're very black and white sometimes in how they hear and understand things. So using sarcasm or metaphors or idioms, they can find that very confusing. Autistic people, some, not all, can find it very hard to read faces and understand what the facial expressions mean and what body language means. So they'll take the words very literally. So within a school, when you've got a lot of sensory issues going on, a lot of noise going on, that ability to communicate when they're struggling because they see and understand things differently can be very hard for them. So keeping language really short and simple and repetitive with a child or young person at school gives them that time and their brain to process that information so that they can then respond back.
And that kind of bombardment of having difficulty sort of reading facial expressions and the sensory needs and all the sort of issues you discussed, often that results in a lot of anxiety, yeah?
Oh, 100%. I mean, autism doesn't come automatically with a diagnosis of anxiety. The anxiety tends to come because they live in a neurotypical environment, which they don't understand. And they find, like you said, the word bombarding, especially school, where the acoustic levels tend to be really bad. There's pictures and sound, things all over the place. And if they're feeling anxious and a teacher's trying to communicate to them to do some work, but they're still just trying to settle because something might have changed in the classroom that day compared to yesterday, and they're trying to make sense of that whilst they've also been asked to do some schoolwork. And then they get upset because they didn't realize they'd missed that question. So again, about keeping things really simple, you can reduce that bombardment of too much sensory overload.
How has your child's autism affected their experience of school? And I guess your experience of school too as a parent?
It's sad really because unfortunately we tend to get diagnosed very late. There's not an early enough diagnosis. So my son wasn't diagnosed until he was just over 7. He'd already had 4 years experience at school, which was negative, where therefore the anxiety had built up. And I must admit the school had tried everything, the mainstream school. It just wasn't the right environment for him. And then the next hurdle was having to fight to get him into a school, which was the right environment for him. And he flourished. The difference within a week of him being in a special school, he flourished and did really well at primary. The hurdle then again was at secondary. So he hasn't really had a secondary education because I think there's even in special schools still, there's still a lot of emphasis around behavior and trying to tap into sorting out that behavior rather than understanding that all behavior is communication and rather trying to look at the journey of where that behavior came from. We're trying to nip the behavior in the bud and never really understanding, well, what's the anxiety? What are the difficulties? And talking with that child or young person and getting them and giving them the opportunities to communicate that. We're trying to sort out the behavior. And all that does is just escalate things and make the situation worse.
And I suppose here there's a difference between chosen behavior, where kids are making logical planned choices about what they're doing, and behaviors that have an emotional root because you feel overwhelmed or you're not coping or you're finding it difficult to understand what's going on around you.
Very much so. But again, for me, for all the work I've been doing over the years, I just feel that schools are still, especially mainstream schools, are still missing out. There should be, in this day and age of 2022, with access to the internet, and there's free information and resources out there everywhere for autism, for everybody, that schools don't just have that basic package when they know that a child may have autism or definitely has a diagnosis of autism. that they put this basic package into place straight away so you can relieve some of that anxiety, like a visual timetable, like a timeout card, like a quiet space, a key person they can talk to, but also talking to the parents, because don't forget the parents are the experts, and the parents might have little tricks which the school could implement. And I feel that's still very much lacking in schools, so that it then escalates really quickly. And then you're dealing with challenging behaviour and that reactive behaviour. And we're trying to pick up the mess of that rather than prevention and putting things in place before that.
It sounds like the right structures aren't in place in school.
No.
Like taking it from a whole school perspective, not just relying on individual teachers to do individual bits of good practice, but actually how do we plan to support students who are neurodiverse, who have a diagnosis? How do we help them succeed in a way that's almost systematic?
There needs to be better training. I mean, it was talked about years ago that at teacher training level, they were going to get better training in SEN. I've yet to see that happen. And I've met quite a few NQTs who've done a day. That's not enough, especially when we're seeing the prevalence rise. That's not because there's more people. I think it's just we've become more aware of it. So from a standing point, our teachers aren't trained, and that's not fair also on the teachers either. So I'm not against the teachers, because there are some amazing teachers up there who want to do their best, but they're not being given the tools either. Then the parents aren't being trained. So you wait 3-4 years for a diagnosis. You wait forever. You go around that revolving door, and then it's, here's your diagnosis, goodbye. And the parents aren't trained to understand, well, what are these neurodiverse conditions and why are they different and how can you support? And then more importantly, the child and young person aren't being trained and taught about, well, what is autism and how is it for you individually? So right from an age when they can start understanding, we're not teaching them. So they can hold it in a positive way rather than a negative way. So those are three areas. All those three key groups of people are not being trained and experienced. And then it's not been openly talked about. It's almost like it's brushed under the carpet and parents are taken aside rather than, children are so resilient and are so caring and so loving. You know, all the schools should understand about neurodiversity in a positive way and go, oh, I didn't realize you see things differently. It should be a much more positive language within a school rather than this negativity and this constant reinforcement and negative reinforcement all the time.
You said you had to fight for your child to receive the support they need in school. And we've started touching on this really based on the lack of training and understanding. What attitudes or misconceptions did you have to overcome to get the support that your child needed?
Sadly, the attitude and misconception I had to get over is that the local authority is on my side and that the local authority is there to support us. And sadly, that misconception has, I finally seen the truth on that. And I'm sure you hear that from a lot of parents. And it's not only just the families whose misconception of the local authority is changed. It's also the schools, because I know a lot of good schools will reach out for support from the local authority and they're not getting it either. The onus is put on those individual groups. Since the 2014 new law, the whole idea was about everyone working in partnership together, and it's still not happening. Here we are nearly 8 years later, and we're still not all working together, remembering that the main focus should be about the child and young person. So that's another misconception. I believe that my child would be the centre of everybody wanting to do it. And sadly for me, all I'm seeing is that it's always around resources. Everything always comes back to money.
One word that I hear parents and schools, to be fair, use repeatedly when it comes to the EACP application process, which is the mechanism by which we can get extra long-term support for kids in school, if you're outside the UK, is fight. The word fight comes up again and again and again. Why do you think that is?
I think we've still got a very archaic system, and we always look at the half empty glass rather than the half full. So like we're still looking at the negativity of neurodiversity rather than the positivity. You know, you've got Bill Gates, one of the richest men in the world with a very successful company, autistic. Same with Elon Musk. There are lots of positivities in neurodiversity, and we're still only looking at the challenging behaviour rather than addressing, wow, how can we build this up? And what happens in the meantime is that because we're not putting in that early intervention, because we're not putting in that training, we're ending up with a lot of children and young people out of education who then are entering adulthood who can't access work and are going to be more of a drain on society, rather than seeing it as we put in that early intervention. I'd say at least 75-80% of SEND children and young people could be proactive when they reach adulthood, and putting a lot into society. And I think we're still approaching it in a very archaic system, where either we'll ignore it until it gets too difficult and then we'll try and fix it, rather than we don't need to fix it. We just need to embrace it and understand it and then incorporate that between our curriculum and everything else.
And it sounds like that's what the provision in primary special school got right for your son. The environment and the support meant he was able to flourish and focus and relax and enjoy that time in school more. Is that right?
Oh, 100%. The meltdowns decreased. The smiles increased. He was accessing learning. He was beginning to start self-regulating because he was given all that information by very experienced, caring, nurturing staff. And then, unfortunately, that kind of changed as soon as he went to secondary.
How did that make you feel as a parent to see your son thriving?
There aren't any words. You know, there were happy tears. I was glad I fought because the fight had worked and I'd got him into the right school. And as a parent, as a mum, seeing my baby not feel bad about himself because, you know, at 7 years old, he was hating being autistic. He hated being himself. He was self-harming. All these things that 7-year-olds shouldn't be doing, but was made to feel that way because he was made to feel that he was in the wrong because of his autism. So to be in an environment where he was surrounded by other children with other needs or similar needs, he realized he wasn't alone in the world. So that took away some of that negativity because he was surrounded by other people who had sometimes more difficulties than him. So that made him more nurturing. So he would be more patient and caring for some of his fellow students. He was happier, started getting more confident. He started seeing a future. And that's all that any parent wants for your child.
I'd just like to take a pause for a moment and say that if you're finding this podcast useful, then you're going to love what we've got waiting for you in our Inner Circle program. The Inner Circle is your one-stop shop for all things behavior. It's a comprehensive platform filled with videos, resources, and behavior inspiration to get you unstuck with classroom behavior. We've got training resources on de-escalation, supporting kids with anxiety, support strategies for conditions like autism, ADHD, and PDA, practical ways of helping pupils deal with strong emotions, assertive behavior management techniques for managing the whole class, setting out your classroom environment for success, resetting behavior with tricky classes, and more. Our online videos walk you through practical solutions step by step. And just like Netflix, you can turn an Inner Circle subscription on or off whenever you need to with no minimum contract. Plus, you can now get your first 7 days of Inner Circle for just £1. Get the behavior answers you've been looking for today with Inner Circle. Visit beaconschoolsupport.co.uk and click on the Inner Circle picture near the top of the homepage for more information.
That's a good time to come on to ABA. So could you tell us a little about ABA, Applied Behaviour Analysis? Could you tell us what it is and what it's used for in sort of general terms?
Well, it's quite funny because I did behavioural analysis at psychology in degree, obviously with Skinner. And it's fine because that's with rats or with monkeys. But human beings are far more complex than that. And our needs are unique and individual. So behaviour analysis is around looking into behaviors you want that child or young person to possibly change. And that's by using a psychological approach, which is using negative and positive reinforcement. So you want to encourage the good behavior or the positive behavior, and you can do that through rewards or through punishment. And ideally, it's about changing that behavior through those approaches.
And this is something you see a lot in schools to manage whole classes, as well as to manage the behavior of individual kids with additional needs.
Yes, I see it failing in schools left, right and center, because what they're doing is they're doing the negative and positive reinforcement for the child or young person. There's no gray area. That's very black and white. So they go to isolation, which I think is just barbaric in its own sense. But the child or young person is vaguely given the rules. They apply those rules. And if they don't, you either get a reward or you get a punishment. But with the punishment, they're not then taught how to change that for next time. They're just punished. So no one ever sits them down and goes, you got punished because of this. Why do you think you did this? And what could you choose to do next time? What could be your choice next time? It's all about punishment. So what that young person or child is doing is not learning anything. They're just being punished. And half the time, especially if they've got neurodiversity, they might be getting punished for disability-led behavior, which is going to confuse them even more because that's out of their control. So I think schools have taken on this behavioral approach, but very simplistic and very black and white, and they're not teaching that child or young person where to go and how to change.
I was speaking to a young man a couple of months ago, and we were talking about how isolation and exclusion wasn't working for him. And literally the words he used were, just punishing me won't help me get better. I need someone to help me learn what to do.
Absolutely. I thoroughly agree with that. That's what schools should be about, because I think we still heavily rely on assuming that families and parents can do it. And sadly, that's not the case in all cases. And I believe schools shouldn't just be about the academic side. How can you learn if you're stressed or you're anxious? How can you learn if you feel sad? And we must be having much more positive talk around mental health incorporated into schools. And then if we are going to use punishment, which I'm not against, but I'm against punishment which doesn't also then reflect and teach. Because like your young man said, all I'm getting is punished. I don't understand why. So how can he change his behaviour? And then he gets punished again. And it ends up in this big cycle of punishment to get to the point where they go, well, I might as well just not bother then. I'll just give up because you're going to punish me anyway.
Punishment without support almost feels like tyranny.
We're on the same page there, Simon.
Many members of the autistic community now oppose how some practitioners are using ABA in particular and how it's being applied to people with autism as actively harmful. Can you tell us about why this is, and can you explain like your concerns about this approach?
My main concern is that it's another area where schools are failing to recognise all behaviour is communication, especially children and young people with autism who have difficulties in communication. That's part of their diagnosis. They have difficulties with interaction, part of their diagnosis, and that can cause high anxiety. We all know that when we're feeling anxious, we all struggle to speak. You add in the fact the brain literally will shut down for most people, but also with neurodiverse people, making it harder for them to communicate. They will find other ways to communicate because we're humans and we need to communicate. And that might be, unfortunately, throwing a chair or something like that. And what we need to be doing is taking my 10-second rule, step back and look at that scenario and go, what are they actually trying to say? Don't just look at the chair throwing. Look at why that chair might be thrown. And what behavior ABA is doing is only looking at that chair being thrown. And therefore, what you're doing is you're taking that voice, their only form of communication, away from an autistic person, because a lot of the time they can't speak verbally. So they might be doing it by stimming, or they might be doing it by rocking or flapping or storming out the classroom or putting their head on the table. That is still them communicating, help, I need help, I am struggling. And with ABA, they're trying to get rid of those behaviours, which means you're taking that voice away from that person with autism and punishing them for communicating in that way.
And often some of those techniques like the flapping and the stimming, often they're a way of trying to regulate the anxiety and stress. So by removing that prop, you're making the problem worse.
But you're also trying to make them neurotypical. And you can't. They have a neurodiverse brain from birth. Well, from before birth in the womb. So you're trying to make their brain do something it actually physically cannot do, because it's not designed to do that. That's not to say that an autistic brain, and that's where routines are so important and consistency is so important, their brain pathways can change over the time if you clearly tell them why you want them to do it, how to do it, and support them to do it consistently. They can understand, like my son in the past, he's learned how to do things. He doesn't understand necessarily why he has to do it, but he gets he has to do it because it's the social norm. So his brain can rebuild those pathways to understand that. But by taking away his self-regulation, which helps him calm down so he can listen and communicate, it's going to block them from doing that. And all you're doing is literally suppressing them, you know, trying to make them to do eye contact. Why? Trying to make to hug. An autistic brain can actually physically tell them that they are in pain from the slightest touch. That's not for us as a neurotypical to say that they're wrong, because that's their brain, not my brain. And it took me years to learn that with my son. And that was also through studying more and more about autism. I realized, your brain, your pain receptors are telling you you're in pain. That's not me to make that choice.
So I'll ask you a hard question now, actually, and it's one I've been thinking about a lot. I don't have an answer from my perspective, but from your perspective, where's the line? What's the difference between supporting kids with areas of need and then, inverted commas, trying to normalize them? Where's the line?
Training and experience and understanding. I think that's the line. The schools I go into, the good schools I go into, it's clear that all members of staff, like the whole school approach happens, that the classmates are informed that they've got autism and that's why maybe they're about behaving this way, that the class teacher is aware of giving them those movement breaks, about allowing to break things down slowly for them, giving them time. So the difference between working with the needs and normalizing is a lack of experience, knowledge and understanding and training.
And is the difference in approach? One is lifting someone up and the other is trying to squash them down into a cage.
Yeah.
Into something they're not.
Absolutely. It's also about that language of acceptance. You know, that comments which parents will have go, oh, I've worked with children with autism before. Yeah, but that's not my child. Or, oh, it's only autism. It is about, like you said, lifting them up rather than pushing them down. And it's about the use of language. I think it's a very much an English thing as well, maybe a Western thing. We're really good at using quite negative language. I don't think we use positive words. We kind of very good at talking at people. We're not very good at actually active listening. And we're not really good at using positive words in the way we talk with people. It's all very negative language. And I think that's the difference with telling someone what to do and asking them how we can support you.
And just to clarify, there are some practitioners out there that are claiming they can, again, in inverted commas, cure autism. That's not right, is it?
Oh, it's absolute rubbish. No, there's no such thing as cure for autism. But you can, with early intervention, depending where you are on the spectrum, but with early intervention and that early support and provision which meet that individual's needs, they won't be cured, but they will have a much better bag of tricks when they go out into that world when they're older, and they can access life, put more into life positively because they feel positive about themselves, because their experience has been, yes, you're autistic. Like, it should be just the same as if with anyone with a condition, we understand the condition, we support it, but it's not what controls and owns you.
From a parent's perspective, what do you think is the motivation of people who claim they can cure autism or change the child sort of inherently?
Money. Because, you know, the SEND community, parents are desperate. By the ages about 7, because they're still waiting for diagnosis a lot of that time, unless they've managed to go private, things start to fall apart at school. That affects the whole home. You've got mental health issues. Parents are desperate. So a lot of ABA practitioners or other practitioners will put it out like they've got this miracle and your life will suddenly come better. And parents are desperate. Families are desperate.
It's predatory.
I think in some cases it is, because it's not true. And they're not empowering the parent and they're not informing the parent. I believe we really should be going back to the basics about teaching that whole family. Well, what is autism? How does that fit your child or young person? And then you start how to support them, not coming in with these great big disclaimers of we can do this or we can do that, which I think a lot of the time are factually untrue and are purely for finance.
We have to say as well, just to be clear, we're not labelling all ABA practitioners like that. We're talking about a small number of people here who are kind of like, yes, misrepresent and are kind of more predatory in their practices. If you're a teacher or a parent listening to this podcast, what's the first step you can take today to learn more about supporting your students who have a diagnosis of autism in your class or school?
There's lots of free websites out there with some amazing information, like the National Autistic Society has got Teachers Resources Pack, Special Needs Jungle, Council for Disabled Children. They've all got those resources. There's plenty of little YouTube videos out there. So I would always recommend go for the really simplest basic one. Don't go for the big peer analysis research papers, which are going to be pages and pages long. Just go for that straight to the point. What autism is from the people who tell you. So on the National Autistic Society, you've got it from the mouths of the people who walk in it, from the child's point of view, the parent's point of view. So as a teacher, really hear that, because I know, and it's no fault for a lot of teachers, but I get the pressure that they're under. That's only for 6 hours a day. What they're not seeing is that morning run where that child has had no sleep. The breakfast and the morning run took an hour and a half and maybe two meltdowns whilst juggling two other children, and the parent's exhausted by the time they get to school. So we're not shouting at you because we hate you. We're shouting at you because we're exhausted and we feel we're not being supported. So for teachers, I'd really would just look at the simplest and go for good sites like National Autistic Society or Council for Disabled Children, who will give clear, honest information and resources for how to support the child, young person and the family with autism. And then I'd also say, talk to the parent. Please have open dialogue and communication with the parent. Majority of parents don't want to scream at you, don't want to shout at you. It is just because we're desperate, because we're not getting that support from anywhere. And then right from the start, when we first start on that pathway, we're questioned by the health visitor, the GP, the school nurse, all these people saying, well, it might not be autism, it might not be this. 5 years down the line, we might have a diagnosis or the behaviours have been much more clear in that way. We really need that communication with the school. We really want that healthy communication with the teacher. But also that parent's full of information. If you want to know, ask the parent.
When everyone works together, you usually get a better outcome.
100%.
And finally, we ask this of all our guests. Who's the key figure that's influenced you, or what's the key book that you've read that's had the biggest impact on your approach to working with kids?
It probably was that module I did with the Open University, because I wasn't expecting it because I hadn't checked my modules. So it suddenly turned up and it was all factual. And I just had the diagnosis. I just got my son into special school, but I still couldn't work. And for me, I work better. I'm a why. Well, why does that happen and what can I do? And the book really told me exactly what autism was, all the different aspects of it. And because of that, I went, it made me parent differently.
In what way?
Well, because I realised a lot of some of the behaviours he was doing were completely out of his control. That was the autism and that was his brain, and he's only young as well. So it taught me to calm down a lot more, to not be reactive to some things because that wasn't out of his control and not his fault. But how I reacted to it could either make it better or worse. It made me see the beautiful side of autism and bring that side out of him. And it made me pick my battles. and realize, why am I getting angry over that when it's completely out of his control?
I imagine that must have had a really positive impact on your relationship.
It did, because it made me, I think for a lot of time we scrabble around while we're waiting for diagnosis. And because we're in that limbo land, we feel we can't say to anybody, well, they might be autistic, therefore I'm going to behave in this way. And everyone's seen a challenge in behavior, and you're kind of feeling you have very British and apologizing unnecessarily. So rather than, well, actually, that's not his fault. It is what it is. It's us, the neurotypicals, who have to adapt and change, because our brain is much more capable of doing that than an autistic brain is. So our relationship definitely became much more positive from that day, because I was able to respect and accept and step back and just calm down a lot more, which makes a world much easier for an autistic person if neurotypical people just calm down a bit.
Nikki, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you for inviting me, Simon.
Okay, very interesting. I think what Nikki highlighted there was the importance of getting systems and training at a whole school level right. So teachers have got the knowledge they need to support kids, and the school as a whole can intentionally meet the needs of their children.
Absolutely.
So this highlights the importance of early intervention. So if you work with kids with challenging behaviour and you're not sure why they're acting that way, we've got a download that can help. It's called the SEN Handbook, and it will help you link behaviours you've seen in the classroom with possible causes such as autism and ADHD.
The idea here isn't for teachers to make a diagnosis, we're not qualified, but if we can link classroom behaviours to possible causes quickly, it means we can get the right help and get early intervention strategies in place.
The handbook is a free download, so go to our website, beaconschoolsupport.co.uk, click on the free resources tab near the top, and we'll also put a link in the episode description.
And if you've enjoyed today's episode, why not do yourself a favour and subscribe? All you've got to do is open your app, tap the subscribe button, or follow us, it's now called in Apple Podcasts, and your podcast app will download each and every episode as it's released, so you never miss a thing. And to celebrate, why not put a fig on a wig, a banana on a piranha, or a melon on a felon? You can choose any fruit and any receptacle as long as they rhyme. Those long summer evenings will just fly by.
I think I'll pass. That's all we've got time for today. I hope you have a great week, and we look forward to seeing you on the next episode of School Behaviour Secrets. Bye.
Bye.